Kura is in the proper mood for going on pilgrimage. In other words, he's in the proper mood for going to Vrindavan because he is going to see Krishna. He is full of anticipation. Without anticipation, without desiring something that we lack, the chemistry doesn't work for anything to happen on the spiritual level. Of course, Krishna's mercy is unlimited, but still our part is to somehow cultivate the desire. And what desire should we cultivate? We have to cultivate our spiritual desires. And with shilanam means the process of cultivation, Krishna and shilanam. So what is the desire we're supposed to cultivate? Very much to do with service. It has to do with service. Devotional service, not just work, but service is an offering, seva. So his desire is very strong to be in the company of Krishna, to actually have the fortune of seeing Krishna and offering his obeisances in the dust of Krishna's feet. He knows who Krishna is, and he's amazed that this opportunity has come to him to see Krishna through the most unlikely source, and that's Kamsa. And it is Krishna who is worshipped by all the demigods, and yet his feet are worshipped, but yet he's wandering around the pasturing grounds herding the cows, and he will see his feet, and then he will see his face, and then he describes his Krishna's face, framed by his curly hair, beautified by his attractive cheeks and nose, his smiling glances, and his reddish lotus eyes. I'm going to see the Supreme Lord Vishnu, the reservoir of all beauty. What does that mean? The reservoir of all beauty. We call Krishna Govinda, the reservoir of all pleasure. What does it mean to be the reservoir of all beauty? The source. If we think of it in a little bit more expanded conceptual terms, it will help us too, because you can think of something being the source of something else, and it's just coming. Just like we can say that the electric wire is the source of the electric power. But we don't get a sense, if we think only in that way, that the sum total of all beauty or of all electricity is possessed by that source. So reservoir is a bit bigger of a concept, that all of beauty, Krishna possesses all beauty. So what does that mean? Or try to consider how attractive all beauty is. And we think that there are beautiful personages in this world, and Krishna, and they possess just the smallest drop of the reservoir of all beauty. So how beautiful is Krishna, and therefore how attractive is Krishna. And it's no wonder that he's charmed everyone. Everyone in Braja completely charmed by Krishna. So he's going to see the Supreme Lord Vishnu. This is what Akura is saying. I am going to see Adya Apyadya Vishnu Manuja Tvam Isho. Today, on this very day, the Supreme Lord Vishnu, Manuja Tvam, the form of a human being, Ayusham, he's assumed the form of a human being. That's how he's describing it. Vara avatareya, for diminishing the burden of the earth, bhuva, nijechaya, by his own desire he's done this. Lavanya damna, he is the abode of beauty. So, what? Think of it like that. He's the abode of beauty. What does abode mean? The dwelling place. So all beauty dwells in him. So what does, think of what that means. That something is attractive in this world, or someone is attractive due to its beauty. And all beauty rests in Krishna. And he's thinking that I'm going to see this Krishna. Lavanya Dhamna, the abode of all beauty. Bhavita Upalambanam Mayam Nanashyat Phalam Anjasa Drisha. There is no denying that my eyes will achieve the perfection of their existence. So this is, again, this is what the gopis said also with Achanvantam Phalamidam Naparam Naparam Vidama. There is no greater goal for the eyes than to see the form of all beauty, because the eyes naturally wish, they long for their object, and there is an interaction between the eyes and the object of the sense of the eyes, which is form. So Krishna's form is perfect, perfectly pleasing to the eyes. But yet when Kamsa saw Krishna, what did he see? Huh? He saw death. The wrestler saw him as a thunderbolt. So again, one is seeing Krishna with one's consciousness, with one's, according to one's mental state, one sees in one way or another. But Akura is expecting to see the perfection of all beauty and the abode of all beauty. There's no denying that my eyes will achieve the perfection of their existence. And that Supreme Lord, who is unlimitedly beautiful, the reservoir of all beauty, who by his own sweet will, he's assumed a human-like form to relieve the earth of her burden. Now, why is he saying that? That by his own sweet will, he's assumed a human-like form. That implies, what does that imply? Of course, that he has other forms. What is that?
He wasn't forced to come.
He wasn't forced to come. He's coming by his sweet will to relieve the burden of the earth, and that's true. Because Lord Brahma prayed to the Lord to become an avatar, to cross downward to this realm from this, because of the overburden. Yada, yada, yadamasya. So he's perceiving the Supreme Lord as Lord Narayan or Lord Vishnu, and that he's assumed this this two-arm form in this incarnation. So he's seeing him as Vishnu, that because he's a devotee basically of Lord Vishnu, he's coming from a different platform of devotion. This is what Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says. But one may object, because he's talking about how fortunate he's going to be. Even demons, one may object. Why are you saying you're so fortunate? Even demons get Krishna's darshan. What's the name? What kind of a demon got Krishna's darshan? Bakasura, Keshi, Aristasura, Putana. So why are you thinking yourself so fortunate? Why do you praise your own good fortune in this manner? And Akura thought, now Vishnu, who is extraordinarily beautiful, whose extraordinary beauty I'm realizing in my heart, has appeared by his sweet will within our own dynasty of Vaivaswatamanu. The demons may see him, but they do not perceive his sweetness. Will my eyes not become successful today? Certainly they will. So many subtle points also come out in this comment to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Those of a demonic mentality, or even those of a neutral mentality, they can see the Lord, but they don't actually see him, because again, one doesn't see with one's eyes, one sees with one's consciousness, and according to one's consciousness, one perceives the Lord differently. Raso Vaisa. He is the reservoir of all rasa. All relationships exist in him. But also in this is his own consciousness, because Krishna is unlimited. So he's going to see the Vishnu form, because that's his worshipable deity. That's his consciousness. So this is exalted consciousness. But he doesn't see Krishna the same way that the residents of Vrindavan see Krishna. They see him as really as the reservoir of all beauty. And according to how one sees Krishna, Krishna reveals, yayitam mam prapadyante tamstu tarvabhajamyam. Krishna reveals by his mercy as much of his beauty as our consciousness can hold, we can say. So the demons have very contracted, inimical consciousness, so they don't perceive the beauty of Krishna, but they perceive other aspects of him. They perceive that he is in fact death personified, because Krishna is in fact death personified. He enforces this rule, this unbreakable law in this world, that everything born must die. So he is the enforcer of that. So that is an aspect of him. He's like a thunderbolt. Where does the thunderbolt get its shocking power from that causes fear? We may think ourselves very secure, and then if we're outside of something and there's a thunderbolt, suddenly we become back into a mouse. This is what we are, because it is Krishna who's giving that potency, and his power and his partially exhibited localized power as Paramatma. He is that too. This is the absolute truth. This is, in the words of the Bhagavatam, this is Advaya Gyan. This is non-dual. The absolute truth is non-dual substance. And he's perceived differently according to the mode of worship. So, Brahmeti, Paramatmekti, Bhagavan Iti Sabhyate. So there are three levels, basic levels, of realizing this one absolute truth. It's not that three are absolute truths or infinite absolute truths. But everyone is perceiving the absolute truth differently according to his consciousness. So the materialist perceives the Lord as death itself, and Krishna is reciprocating with the consciousness that the living entity possesses. So this is the one absolute truth whose existence is everywhere, and is perceived in basically three different ways. So by the jnanis, who have He reveals himself, the one absolute truth, reveals himself as the non-dual Brahman, whose potency is spread everywhere, and everything in existence is him, the oneness of all. And the yogis perceive that same absolute truth in a more localized way. What does localized mean?
In the heart.
Yeah, okay. But because Brahman is qualityless and it's everywhere, and when one perceives Paramatma, he perceives that he's everywhere, but he's everywhere, but in a localized way, with qualities. He's there in the heart, but he's also there in the atoms, and he's there between every atom, within every atom. So that means he's also all-pervading, but he's there in a localized way, as an individual, in an individual form, not in a formless fashion like is Brahman. But in that localized form, the yogis don't perceive his personality exactly. They perceive his qualities. And you can, and one can actually classify different spiritual paths or religious paths in these three ways. And because people who are religious, which are certainly better than the people who are non-religious or atheistical, they will perceive the Lord in one of these three ways. And in the beginning, if you look at what they're saying, it appears always it all appears the same. But then when you read a little further and you see that they think that God is either everything in existence in an equal way, he's as much as the breeze and the clouds, and I am also ultimately one with him. So there's so many different paths that speak like this. And then there's the ones who see his mercy and his other qualities, but they don't know anything about his personality, except they're a little afraid of him, because if you're not good, he can fix you really good, like no one else can fix you. But personality, the actual nature, his actual personality, that is a very, very secret and special thing, to be able to perceive that. And the example that I find myself always giving is that of the king. Most citizens, what is their relationship with the king? Most of them just see him in relationship to the government, the power that he is. And then there's others who get to go to the court. And actually in the Vedic times, not even the Vedic times, but the pre-modern times, when some very good kings were ruling in the land of Bharat, of India, they used to have some of them had a rope that went out to the court, to the center of town, that went right into their dabar, their court where they would hold court, and there was a rope tied to a bell or something. I don't think it was tied to the king's leg or anything. But if anyone had a complaint or a problem, they had the right, any of the citizens, they would pull the rope and they would get the attention of the king. In my kingdom, there's a problem. And it was his responsibility to solve it. So you went and saw the power when you had difficulty. And you saw him, the person, the power, but in his localized form as the king. And there was one king who had a golden rope like that. So what is that saying? How long would a golden rope last anywhere nowadays? What is that saying? I'm the king, I'm the power. You touch this rope, it's for a particular purpose of service. You pull it, you get my attention. If you steal it, it's off with your head. You know, no one would consider doing that because they're dealing with the power. Localized power, though. So when you come into the king, you don't get his personality, you get it. But he's not impersonal. He has qualities. He listens to you. That means he can hear. He deals with your case. He judges. He's powerful. He's sitting up here and you're down here. You're reverential. You don't let your mobile phone go off and carry on a conversation with someone. That's why when we're in front of the deities, we don't have third-party conversations. It's not proper because the worship, you don't talk to you, start talking to your friends. You don't take your camera and take pictures of your friends in front of the deities, because would you do that in front of the king, who's like that, who's so powerful? No, there's too much reverence, veneration. You don't do that because he might not, because when you're in front of the king, when you're in front of the deities, all your attention must be on him. Otherwise, it's, okay, but what is, that's what we call it, but what, just think of it in terms of the king, what is it?
Disrespectful.
Disrespectful, yes. So it's very dangerous to be disrespectful to the king. You can't say, well, anyway, it's just only the king. Because he's not just sitting there, only the king. It's the king, and he's got his guards and his ministers and lots of guards and his armies right there. And if you're disrespectful to him, it's very dangerous. But yet, how many of the citizens who have the opportunity or who come before the king actually know what his personality is exactly, other than these particular qualities, what he likes to eat, what he, this kind of thing and that kind of a thing, the kind of sense of humor he has, maybe he doesn't play musical instruments in court. What instrument does he like to play? If he likes to take care of cows, you'll never know it, because it would be improper for you to view the king in his very private way, taking care of the cows, brushing the cows, hugging the cows, because that will interfere with your relationship with him as the king, because you'll think, well, he's just a coward boy. But actually, he has all the power of the king. His power doesn't diminish when he's a coward boy. It's just a different aspect of him, different aspect of his nature. So when he's sitting on the throne, he has that's the localized power, that's of government, that's pervading the kingdom. But when he's out playing and doing just what he wants to do and joking and laughing and everything, that very intimate behaviors, most people can't see that. They have to be very qualified to see that. So Krura, even though he's going to see Krishna in his own house, in his private quarters, with the cows, with his mother and father, with his friends playing, with a peacock feather on his head, still his own qualification is to see him as Vishnu. But yet, the demons may see him. But just like the good citizens, the law-abiding citizens see the king, they feel like they're seeing their father, their shelter, the most trusted of persons. And indeed, it's called Prajapati, the protector of the praja, of the dependent citizens. But when the thieves see him, the criminals see him, and in this analogy, they're the demons. They're opposed to the law and order of God. What happens when they see him? What are they thinking? Uh-oh, I've stolen. He's going to chop off my hand. I'm fearful. So they don't actually see the same thing, the same king, get the same reassurance. They don't see their father, they see death, they see their punisher. But it doesn't have anything to do with the king. He's not forcing them to see in that way. It's due to their consciousness. So he, Akura, being a devotee, a great devotee, knows that he will see the sweetness of the Lord, the powerful, localized sweetness of the Lord, and that is the perfection of the existence of his eyes. So when we ask ourselves, why can't I see Krishna, or I want to see Krishna, the Prabhupada answered, you can see him. This is how he would say it. You can see him in water. This is maybe our qualification. We could see him as, we could see him in the form of the deity. Before we can see Krishna in Vrindavan, let us first come have our consciousness proper when we see the deity of the Lord. To see, yes, here is Krishna. And actually, if our consciousness, like what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu saw Lord Jagannath, he saw him as Shyamasunda because of his consciousness. He saw him as so beautiful and he couldn't keep his eyes off of him. He was so fixed, he was staring at him continuously. And when he couldn't see him for 2 weeks at the time of, what is it called, Anusvara, when after the Snanayatra festival, after Lord Jagannath is bathed, he becomes ill for 2 weeks, and he's not seeing visitors for 2 weeks while they repaint him for the Rath Yatra and repair any repairs in the painting, because they use this kind of paints that aren't these plastic paints. They use very old fashioned natural paints of this smearing. So when he couldn't see Lord Jagannath, when Mahaprabhu couldn't see Lord Jagannath for 2 weeks, he was completely disturbed of consciousness. He wouldn't even stay in Puri. He would go to Alalanath, where he could see the forum form of the Lord. Have you seen Alalanath? Have you seen the deity? So he was seeing in one consciousness that when he couldn't see, it was so disturbing. So that's how he was perceiving the deity of Lord Jagannath. So he continues. He is the witness, more about him, because see how his consciousness, because he's coming from outside of Braja. He doesn't quite have Braja consciousness, even though he knows Krishna. He is the witness of material cause and effect. Who is the witness?
Super soul.
The super soul. And yet he is always free from false identification with them, meaning with cause and effect, with the dealings of the material world. By his internal potency, he dispels the darkness of separation and confusion. So vasya traham vidhi sanavisto mitmata smitim jnanam aponam cha. The individual souls of this world, who are manifested here, when he glances upon his material creative energy, Mahavishnu, indirectly perceive him in the activities of their life, air, senses, and intelligence. So he's giving a logical argument that everyone, by his potency, we're all seeing and we're acting. And we're able to see by his potency, because in the Vedic consideration of how the eyes work, There are three factors. There's the four factors, really. there's the ultimate factor, which is the Supreme Lord, and then there's Adidevata, Adibhautika, and Adiatmaka. There's the physical sense organ. There's the demigod Adidevata, who controls the self, the sense organ. And then there's the third, this point, the sense object. So these three things have to be combined for, and they're interdependent, because unless the demigod in charge of the sight is there. Who is the demigod in charge of sight? Surya. But unless he's present, and unless the object is present, and unless the eye is present, the seeing doesn't see. The seeing doesn't take place. And then there's the one who is the resting place of all of those three, who gives the power and the energy, because when you have something that's organized, there always has to be an organizer upon whose energy it's resting. So he's the one who that is resting on. So indirectly we can perceive his existence in the activities of the life airs, the senses, the intelligence, because my life air is by my consciousness and everything, I will hand, I will it to happen, hand, raise. So it seems like such a common everyday thing, you know, and I take it so much for granted, but if my life airs aren't working, I could, like, if we're sick, very, very sick, if we become ill, we can't lift out a finger, we can't do anything. So we take that for granted, thinking, oh, it's so simple. All I have to do is want to do it. I can practically do it unconsciously. I can just do what I want. But actually, it's a very, very intricate combination of the material energy. And just think about it. How does the thought, because the mind is thinking, feeling, and willing. So that there's the thinking, and then there's the feeling is the desire. You know, some desire, not the word desire, but I want to lift this. There's an emotion, a need, or a desire comes in the mind, and then I think about it, and then I will it. Means karta. Then it happens. So it's very, very. It's not so simple, because otherwise, how does the mind? It starts with the mind. How does the mind connect with something physical? The mind is so subtle. So you have this very, very subtle interactions going on that we don't think about and we don't take for granted, but actually we can indirectly perceive something about the potency of the Lord when we look at it with a little bit of scrutiny. So he's talking about the super soul, who is the coordinator and the permitter, the Anumanta, Bharta Bhokta Maheshwara. He is the Mahaishwara. Dehis min prusha para, he's within everyone's body as the super soul. So here is the purport. In this verse, Akur establishes the all-powerful position of the Supreme Lord, who is about to see in Vrindavan. The false concept of separation from the Lord is described in the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam, 2nd chapter, 37th verse. Bhayam dvitiya abhinavesha tasya isad apetasya viparitosmati. Although all in existence emanates from the absolute truth, Krishna, we imagine a second thing, dvitiya, bhayam. So this is the cause of the fear that we have, is because we see duality. Viparyato smriti means we see our intelligence is upside down. We see things inaccurately. Mm-hmm. We see ourself as separate from the Supreme Lord, and we see other items, because we want them for ourselves, we see them also as separate from the Supreme Lord. So, and that's inaccurate, because there is nothing, by definition, that can be separate from the absolute truth. So with this mentality, we try to exploit that second thing for for our sense gratification. Thus, the psychological underpinning of material life is the illusion that this world is somehow separate from God and therefore meant for our enjoyment. It is ironic that the impersonal philosophers, in their radical renunciation of this world, claim it to be utterly false and totally separate from the Absolute. Unfortunately, this artificial attempt to divest this world of its divine nature, or in other words, its relation to God, does not lead people to utterly reject it, but rather to try and enjoy it. So that's an irony. And we don't see it as God's property, which is the Vaishnava viewpoint, that Nirbandha Krishna Sambandha Yukta Vairagya, that everything is His, so I can't renounce it, so because it's not mine to renounce. So the impersonalists who say it's not real, rather than acknowledging that it has everything in existence has a connection to God, indirectly cause people to want to enjoy it because they can't say it's not real. How are you going to live thinking the world isn't real? What are you going to do to eat? What are you going to do to... The world forces you to accept its reality whether you like it or not. If you say that step isn't real, and you try to walk through without putting your foot up, what's going to happen? You bang your nose. So people have to, because they're not taught to see things in relationship to who things really belong to, and they can't see things as unreal or illusory. So the third alternative is what everyone does. Well, here it is, and here I am. So let's go. While it is true that, so he points it out as an irony, that indirectly this impersonalism and the mood of the jnanis causes sense gratification, and their whole process is one of renunciation. While it is true that this world is temporary and thus in one sense illusory, the mechanism of illusion is a spiritual potency of the Supreme Lord. Realizing this, we should immediately desist from any attempt to exploit this world. Rather, we should recognize it as God's energy. We will actually give up our material desires only when we understand that this world belongs to God and is therefore not meant for our sense gratification, selfish gratification. The word abhiyate here refers to a process of surmising the presence of the Lord through meditative introspection. This process is also described in the second canto of the Bhagavatam. Bhagavan sarvabhuteshu lakshita swat manahari drishya bud yadhibhya drasta lakshana anu mapakai. The personality of Godhead Lord Sri Krishna is in every living being along with the individual soul, and this fact is perceived and hypothesized in our acts of seeing and taking hope from the intelligence. It's a famous verse with a long, long, long purport. So with the intelligence we can hypothesize, we can perceive that there is a God. Akura states that the Lord is free from egoistic pride afflicting ordinary embodied souls, yet the Lord appears to be embodied like everyone else. And therefore, someone might object to the statement that he is free of egoism. Srila Vishnu Chakravarti comments on this puzzle as follows. How can we distinguish between being free of false ego and being afflicted by it? If a living entity is situated in a body, argues the objector, he will encounter the unhappiness and confusion that occurs within it, just as a person living in a house, whether he's attached to it or not, cannot avoid experiencing the darkness, warmth, and cold that occurs within it. So he's setting forward, because someone may argue that, well, Krishna has an ego because he has a form. So, and to show that, and even if you say that he's realized in some way, how can you not be affected by your what goes on in your body, even if you are realized? Just like if you're in a house, if the house is cold, you feel cold. If the house is warm, you feel warm. So it does affect you. So that means you'd have an ego. So the answer, the objection is answered as follows. By his internal potency, the Lord dispels the darkness of ignorance along with the separateness and bewilderment it produces. So there is no Maya that causes Krishna to, that influences Krishna's experiences, because Krishna is Sambhavam Yatma Maya. He's working by his internal energy, his own potency. So we are tiny, and we come under the influence of Maya, and even though we are not our bodies, we have read it so many times, but still when our body feels cold, we feel cold. And when our body feels hungry, we feel hungry. And when our body feels tired, we feel tired. This connection, this inconceivable connection between spirit, the soul, and the subtle material energy and gross material energy is done by the work of Krishna's Maya. But Krishna's Maya doesn't act on Krishna. So there's no... because it's his energy, and it's divinely inspired by him, but he is the controller of the energy. Anyway, this is what is being described about Kura is describing, because he's thinking, after all, this is the potency of the person I'm going to see. He's so powerful. He's the witness of everything. He's controlling everything. He's a super soul in everyone's heart. And I'm going to see him. That's quite exciting. And he's described his beauty already. All sins are destroyed and all good fortune created by the Supreme Lord's qualities, activities, and appearances. And words that describe these three things, animate, beautify, and purify the world. On the other hand, words bereft of his glories are like the decorations on a corpse. I'll read that again. It's quite wonderful. All sins are destroyed, and all good fortune is created by the Supreme Lord's qualities. What's the Sanskrit word for that? And his activities, lila, and appearances. And words that describe these three things, his appearances, that means his birth, janma, karma, chamay, divyam, his qualities, and words that describe these things, they animate, they beautify and purify the world. So they give life to the world. In other words, the world is, and all the things of this world, he compares them to, bereft of his glories, they're like the decorations on a corpse. What does that mean? Has anyone ever seen a decorated corpse? Yes. Well,
I find it a bit bizarre.
Does it make the corpse look beautiful, does it?
They try to, but it seems a bit strange.
Yeah. When someone very close to you, too.
Not that close, but it's not friendly.
Oh. So what is the decorations on a live body make something beautiful? But no matter how many decorations you put on a corpse, it's just because
at the end of the day you want to bury it or cremate it.
Huh?
At the end of the day you want to bury it or cremate it.
Because the thing that the source of the beauty isn't the decorations, and it's not the body, it's the soul. So what's the analogy that's given here? It's because there's two parts of the verse. One, what's being compared to the decorations of a dead body? Anyone remember? I'll read it again. All sins are destroyed and all good fortune created by the Supreme Lord's qualities, activities, and appearances. And words that describe these things animate, beautify, and purify the world. On the other hand, words bereft of his glories are like decorations on a corpse. So we can, someone can say so many wonderful, sweet words, but if it's just like decorations on something that's dead, unless they're words glorifying the activities, the pastimes, the form, the qualities of the Supreme Lord, that's his point. And it's true. I used to listen to the news on the radio some years ago, and it gives like a dead feeling in the heart. It doesn't, the words don't have life. They're words, and you read very fine poetry glorifying the things of this world, and the great novel, and it's actually dead. It doesn't have any true meaning because it's just interactions of one dead thing and another dead thing. So if you interact dead things with each other, it's only dead things interacting. But those same words, when properly applied to the Supreme Lord, Uttama Sloka, then they're the most wonderful thing, and that's what the Bhagavatam is. Anyone like to comment on that? Because it's interesting points. Because the conditioned soul, even when we're aspiring to be devotees, a difficult circumstance, because our taste isn't really there completely, but yet the taste, and we longing to taste sweetness, and then we try to taste it in the material realm, and we just taste ashes, which aren't very sweet.
Sometimes interesting or glittering initially, and then it goes flat. And it's only some life development of consciousness.
Yeah.
So when something strange happens, like the Tamil Nadu or the tsunami or something, it sort of grabs your attention for a bit. And after a while, you get tired of it.
And they're trying to squeeze more and more out of it. But everything is like that.
Yeah. I find that because it's basically dead, therefore the emphasis becomes anticipation.
Yeah.
So you build something up.
Yeah.
But it's all before the event, because the actual event is not often very much.
Yeah.
Most of
the pleasure is in the anticipation.
Yeah, most and of the talk and discussion and the rasa is all in the anticipation.
And also you can also get a little bit of pleasure of talking about it to your friends after. You know what I did, you know what I haven't. And maybe you can even evoke some envy in them too. And then you get a little taste out of that.
Yeah.
And you can go around in your car. I mean, you get this. You can get a big $13 million house, but all it is bedrooms and kitchens and stairs and bathrooms. And, it's the same old thing.
Yeah.
So, but at least the people walking by, when they look at it, they can say, "Oh, what a fortunate person must live in there." Mm. See, a little pleasure like that. He must be so great, huh?
The whole world is ashes. So, it's not. Nothing to describe a book. No meaning. It goes to a couple of hours to decorate Suti Rani when she left him. Made her a gopi or something. I could not understand the meaning of all that. Even the living world is dead, but what about the dead one?
She has to wear something.
I was at my brother's once, and he had cable TV on, and advertisement after advertisement kept telling them what shows they were going to have next month. And what they're already watching is not good enough, but keep subscribing because next month we're going to have this, we're going to have that. that sense of that point.
Anticipation.
You know, you're not really enjoying what you've got this month, but don't drop your subscription because next month we're going to have this.
And then, I mean, it's all advertising. Well, that's the whole field of advertising, is just giving you the hope against hope, and all of your experience to this date that you know by this shopping you're going to finally get what something that's going to bring you satisfaction. It's all lies. It's a world of lies.
Shabko hum rangarum paadar de manako hum utsit chit bina de shabka. It means...
You can understand it, Tai?
Huh?
I was asking Nittai if he...
He didn't understand a bit.
Yeah, he didn't. The Hindi part.
We decorate the dead bodies and give lot of, you know, honor and respect to them. But then they are alive, we make them dead. Alive we don't care at all, you know, they are just like dead, we leave them aside. And when they die, then we decorate them.
Yeah. Today, that same Supreme Lord, this again is his anticipation that he's going to actually see the source of satisfaction, Krishna. That same Supreme Lord has descended into the dynasty of the Satvatis to delight the exalted demigods who maintain the principles of religion. He has created. Residing in Vrindavan, he spreads his fame, which the demigods glorify in song, and which bring auspiciousness to all. So here's his relationship to the demigods. He's describing that he's actually the Supreme Lord, and he's come to serve them. So even the Supreme Lord comes to serve, and he's created the laws, and they're enlivened by his appearance. There's no real comments here. The same Supreme Lord has descended into the dynasty of the Satvatis to delight the exalted demigods who maintain the principles of religion. He has created, delighting them because they were having problems maintaining the principles of religion in his service because of the overburden of the demonic forces in the world. So they become delighted when the Lord comes to Dharma Sanstap and Artaya to reestablish the principles of religion that he himself has created and help them in their service. And residing in Vrindavan, he spreads his fame, which the demigods glorify in song, and which brings auspiciousness to all. They glorify him, and that is the greatest of auspiciousness for everyone, to hear the glories of the Lord. And if we don't hear the glories of the Lord, we'll end up hearing other glories and become attracted to other glories, and that plants so many material desires in our consciousness. And that causes our death again and again. It all has to do with desires. So we want to, what we're trying to do is increase our desire by hearing to serve, increase our desire to serve Krishna. That's what we're trying to do. To increase our desire, because everything rests on a desire. It's described in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Just like the reflection of the tree rests upon water, our situation in the material world is based on our desire. It rests on our desire. That's a very heavy thought if you think about it. My situation rests on my desire. So now I'm getting the fruit of my desires. How do you like the taste? Well, it's not so good today, but tomorrow it'll be better. The next day, if I just can get one of these, get rid of this one problem and clear my credit card debt and fix my car, and then I could do this and that, and then everything's just going to be so nice.
Point of desire is one of the salient features of Buddhism, negating desires.
What is our take on that? How do we view that?
Well, we also ichha dvesha mokheno dhamma mokheno bhaya. Our name is the same radically. But the more your desires, the more the sort of the cobwebs you keep on weaving and getting entangled.
Because Buddhism has its roots, of course, in the Vedic culture.
Yes.
But it's not possible, obviously, to negate desire, because first thing you have to do is desire to not desire. So as soon as you start desiring, because desiring is one of the motive passion, so you desire to not desire. I have such a strong desire not to desire, and that's what happens, and you end up fighting with yourself all the time.
Means if we understand the nature of desire,
yes,
then we'll be able to overcome it. It's an intellectual phenomenon at the same time.
Unless you desire something superior, how can, by intelligence alone is not sufficient to remove the tendency, because it's the soul that's desiring, it wants something, it's longing. So artificially, one can put oneself in a situation for a short time where one is not desiring by breathing, by just meditating, but as soon as something comes along, it can just knock you right out of that, because the soul itself is, it's alive, it wants. So because we don't want to suffer, we pull ourselves back from desiring. But really, the only way that we can stop desiring on a lower level is to have the most incredible, powerful desires on the higher level. Param Dushvinavartate, that's Krishna's point.
You can't exert and maintain control through the head desires. No, you can't sustain it.
Thinking, feeling, willing. So the feeling is the bhokta. The thinking is the gyatva and karta. So which one out of those three is the strongest? Huh?
Mm-hmm.
All those who think thinking is the strongest, raise your hand. All those who wish thinking was the strongest, raise your hand. But it's feeling.
Mm-hmm.
We get driven by our feelings more than anything. This is so many different. The Stoic philosophers in ancient Greece, they were trying to remove all feelings from a man, and just we can just be rational. Man is rational, completely rational. He only does what's right. Until India beats, until Pakistan beats Indian cricket, and then all hell breaks loose.
Because
we have the subtle, there's the subtle body, but at the bottom of that is this thing called the Prabhupada referred to it as the subconscious, but it's like the bag of all the impressions, samskaras we've had for thousands and thousands and thousands of births, and our thinking is on one level, and this pragya, which is what does that mean?
I'm finished.
I'm about finished too then. But we have all this subconscious stuff that drives us. You don't even know about, you know, that's pushing you and pushing you and pushing you and pushing you, thinking that you're rational, but actually all these subconscious longings and pushings are there that are impressions from so many previous lives who were puppets to these things.
That's how psychiatrists are flourishing.
Yeah. Anyway, that's a whole other interesting topic. Okay. That's why you're meditating, and you say, from now on, I'm going to listen to all my rounds, and I'm going to not miss hearing anything. I'm just going to meditate, or I'm going to only do this, and then just some desire pops up from somewhere or another, and then boom, all your thinking is finished. Even for powerful yogis, what to speak of. So we have a different process. That's the thinking process. And Krishna consciousness is also there's the physical things to do, there's the thinking things to do, and there's also the feeling things to do.
Mm.
So we're supposed to see the deities and feel something too.
Mm.
Bhakti means the offering of the bhakta is offering bhakti, which is the Lord's own internal energy. Devotion, and that's what Krishna is tasting, the devotion.
Good night.